David and Goliath. One of the greatest religious tales is the biblical story of David and Goliath. Like all powerful allegories, it's true even if it didn't happen, to use the words of Jack Kerouac. It reveals an eternal truth about the nature of man, the nature of God, and the nature of the world. David was a young boy when God first looked into his heart and chose him to become the king of Israel. During the years of his circuitous route to the throne, he was, among other things, King Saul's personal musician and a shepherd. As a youth, and with no professional military training, David seemed an odd choice to kill a giant, yet Goliath threatened the nation, and none of Israel's warriors were brave enough to confront him. They all trembled at the sound of the giant's roar, and only young David volunteered to take him on. Goliath was not only a giant. He was also equipped with 150 pounds of armor, carried a massive spear, and had a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. He had all the ego and bravado of a warrior villain. He taunted and mocked David, who had no armor or ammunition except a sling with 5 smooth stones. Yet David solemnly proclaimed that he would win victory over the giant, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. With that, David shot his sling, landing 1 smooth stone right in the middle of Goliath's forehead. Goliath dead, David then used the giant's own sword to behead him. For the spiritually motivated activist, that story is everything we need to know, revealing the Achilles heel of a monstrous status quo. Its meanness, but also its vulnerability, is its dissociation from its own soul. When its conscience is struck, it is automatically transformed. David had the power of God's love on his side. Contrary to appearances, the giant was the one who didn't stand a chance. There is one power that a mean, soulless, worldly juggernaut cannot defend against or effectively destroy. That is the power of love and its weapon of faith. Goliath is a giant, symbolizing worldly power bigger than any one person. He is heavily armored, symbolizing something impossible to touch, emotionally or physically. He has a piece of bronze slung between his shoulders, symbolizing something which is heavily armed. David is a musician, which symbolizes the intuitive, mysterious power of the right side of the brain. He is a shepherd, symbolizing the caretaker, or those who take care of the lambs of God. David's youth and faithfulness give him the courage and power to confront the giant and to have victory over him. Today in America, there is a new Davidic impulse. The young, the used to be young, and the faithful join together. If we have courage and we have faith, we too will slay the giant in our midst. Faith and action. Two things make David important: who he is and what he does. We must address both those issues within ourselves in order to become serious vessels for transforming the world. David's two significant aspects are his faith and his action. Faith is the belief in things unseen, a hearkening to principles that a materialistic world does not acknowledge. It is an experience that far transcends religious dogma. Faith gives a different set of eyes that we might see a different world. David had faith, and from it he drew his power. Faith brings not a weakening of the personality, but a strengthening of it, for it provides more data to the brain as well as to the heart. It expands one's awareness by positing the reality of a world beyond the one we perceive with our physical senses. It is not an irrational, but a super-rational take on life. It represents a shift from living one's life based on extrinsic calculations to one based on intrinsic understanding. There are universal themes and articles of faith. At the center of them all is love. Faith in God is faith in love, and its power to ultimately sustain us, renew us, and make straight our paths. It is the ultimate power because love casts out fear. The first responsibility of love, said philosopher Paul Tillich, is to listen. We cannot learn to deeply communicate until we learn to listen to each other, but also to ourselves and to God. Once I was giving a lecture to a large audience, and the subject of abortion came up in the discussion period of the program. Tensions began to surface, and a slight rip appeared in the psychic fabric of the room. One choice was to go for a false positivism, pretending we're also spiritual here, that we don't have to delve into issues like that. Such a choice is not transcendence, but denial, healing nothing and no one. Another choice was to open the discussion, go for it, and see what happens. A third choice offered a different way. I asked the people in the room to close their eyes and silently remain that way for 2 minutes. I asked the audience to look within themselves and call on the spirit of goodness that resides there. I asked them to ask the soul for its wisdom regarding this issue, to deliver their perceptions of this subject into the hands of God. After 2 minutes of silence, we resumed conversation. Everyone in the room was quieter, more accepting and compassionate toward the views of others, and more eloquent in stating their own. The right answer is not a particular view on policy, so much as an experience of each other in which the process of meaningful democracy is restored. We don't need to extend democracy outward on a lateral axis, so much as we need to extend it vertically into our own minds and hearts. Democracy has become a shallow well in America, and remedying that is our answer. The day after that lecture, someone who was there remarked to me, "I felt like last night I had an intimate living room conversation regarding abortion with 2,000 people." Too many Americans today define a political meeting as a place where we go to be with others who are smart enough to look at the world exactly the way we do, all of us joining together in a self-congratulatory spirit to figure out how to impose our opinions on those not yet intelligent enough to agree with us. Our most critical need is for a mode of genuine reconciliation and synergistic dialogue among opposing viewpoints. That is the new politics because it retrieves the process of real democracy. The adversarial games that define politics today are psychologically and socially destructive. Habits of the Heart. In his classic work, Democracy in America, the French philosopher and statesman Alexis de Tocqueville wrote of Americans' habits of the heart. The practice of democracy is indeed a habit of the heart. The habit of voting, to be sure, but also much more than that, of becoming and staying aware, of serving our communities, of communicating, plugging into the system, and owning one's voice. An agreement among two or more people is a mighty power in the universe, and words in support of the agreement give it added weight. There is an exercise where a group sits quietly, much as in a Quaker-style meeting, and when the spirit moves an individual, he or she says loud enough for all to hear, "I see an America in which." One night we had done this exercise at one of my lectures in New York City. Hundreds of people were in the room, and probably 70 or so made their declaration of what they'd like America to be like. Always very interesting and sometimes very funny. I've heard people in New York City say they see an America without lawyers, and people in Los Angeles say they see an America without agents. After the completion of the exercise, the group took a 20-minute intermission. When I came back on stage, it was time for a different part of my presentation, responding to questions handed in from members of the audience. I've been doing this format, lecture, intermission, then questions and answers for years. But this night was different. Almost every time I read a question, before I could say anything in response, someone in the audience would speak up, not raise their hand, but just blurt out an answer, and always it was a good one. I realized that something significant had occurred here. From merely participating in that exercise, people had subtly shifted from passive to active, from non-participatory to participatory, from a mode where someone else is presumed to have all the answers to one where we ourselves have all the answers. People hadn't become wise that night, of course, but many had come closer to owning their wisdom that night. Within minutes, people were talking, completely unprompted by me, of which companies produce their products in countries where child labor is used, the tenets of responsible investing, how to include infant and child care in a corporate environment, economic justice and the U.S. tax code, and what really happened to Flight 800. That, to me, is democracy in action. Average citizens joining in a dignified environment to deliberate issues among themselves. And when that starts to happen, how intelligent we are. Group intelligence and group conscience both exist. The true political issue is how to invoke them. Could have been like David, but we caved. Life has been so relatively easy for many of us that we haven't developed a healthy capacity to burst through obstacles. We cannot allow ourselves to remain stuck at an adolescent level of whining and waiting for someone else to fix things. We must develop the patience, the fortitude, and the strength of personality to use the tools we have. And we do have tools. we have many. It is important that we avoid the temptation to indulge ourselves in whining without taking constructive action. There is no meaningful freedom in the absence of personal discipline. Taking part in the political process through writing letters, making calls, signing petitions, and so on is a habit we must develop if we want the process to transform. David didn't just pray or complain. He acted, and so must we. Paradoxically, part of the problem with an overly yang culture is that it produces overly yin personalities. Without the yin of peace and serenity, there is no character formation. Without that, there's no capacity for the yang of powerful personal action. We desperately need both. Imagine a politics infused with the following Renaissance principles. 1. The power within us is greater than any power outside us. 2. Government should concern itself less with how to allocate our external resources and more with how to harness our internal ones. 3. The source of wealth is our capacity for genius. Creation of wealth through the stimulation of creative thinking is thus the primary source of economic recovery and stimulation. 4. The highest political dialogue is not adversarial, but rather a synergistic conversation between high-minded liberal visions for the country and high-minded conservative ones. 5. The politics of hate is a branch that does not bear fruit. That is why another branch is starting to grow. Love is a more powerful political and social tool than hatred. 6. We will not move forward as a nation without repenting for our lack of righteousness toward other Americans in the past and present and all other nations of the world. 7. We must acknowledge the power of the inner life, the wisdom found in silence, and the primacy of the voice of conscience. Otherwise, the American experiment will end. It will have failed. Citizen power. The key to America's repair lies in the tools of democracy, their proliferation and widespread use. As he left the presidency, Harry Truman was asked how it felt no longer being president. He responded that he had gotten promoted to a better job, Mr. Citizen. Most Americans do not even vote, feeling politics is like a fading reality, having little to do with their actual lives. In many ways, they're right. It is a spectator sport now, when it was intended to be a participatory drama. No American citizen should be watching the action from the sidelines. Each of us has lines to say. And to say that I vote and therefore participate fully as a citizen is like saying that I pay child support and therefore I'm a real parent. An idea grows stronger the more it is shared. If we are to revitalize our experience of citizenship, in certain ways we must do so together. It does not matter that we think alike about the issues. Freedom is a state in which, by definition, we do not. But it matters very much that we think about them, period. Imagine becoming involved in a citizenship gathering, say on a weekly or monthly basis, held in your living room or your neighbor's, a kind of citizen salon. The purpose of such gatherings is that you might become, as a citizen, more involved in the higher political process. It doesn't matter who at the meeting considers himself or herself liberal, conservative, neither, or even apolitical. If you're an American, you belong at such a gathering. One would attend a citizen salon not just to voice his or her opinions, but also to deeply listen to other people's views. Respectful exchange is an extremely important element in democracy. We must refuse to model our political conversations after crossfire. That does not mean we should avoid confrontation at all costs. Healthy debate is part of the democratic process. There is rarely a right answer in politics. The ultimate truth has elements of almost every intelligent person's opinion. If this were not so, we could have a computer make our decisions for us. Nuance, reconciliation, and compassion are things that must be brought to the political table, and the most awakened people bring them. The key to successful citizen salons is that we speak from the heart about subjects that matter. Here are some possible items to include as part of such meetings. 1. Silent meditation or non-denominational devotion. 2. Discussion or visualization of what we as individuals would wish America or the world to be like. 3. An educational element, such as a group reading and discussion. If the meeting is weekly, perhaps one member of the group brings in an article or chapter of a book for group discussion. 4. Citizen lobbying. With every article or discussion, the group should plan a specific lobbying action, such as letters to an elected official. Remember, we do not all have to be lobbying for the same things or expressing the same opinions. Reconciliation should be at the heart of holistic politics, blacks with whites, gays with straights, women with men, Jews with Christians, etc. Mutually respectful, dignified, authentic discussion among members of such groups is part of the value of a holistic political movement. If we don't like the mean-spiritedness of politics as we know it, it is up to us to reinvent it. A minimum of 2 minutes of devotional common silence before, during, or after a citizen salon is highly recommended. Remember the power of prayer, meditation, and positive intentionality. An opening prayer might be as follows. Dear God, we come together, different perspectives, different politics, different cultures, to ask that you heal us all, to ask that you heal our country. We surrender to you the thoughts and attitudes we now hold, and empty our minds that they might be filled by you. Show us to each other as you would have us see each other. Show us the world as you would have us see the world. Guide our listening as you would have us hear each other. Teach us and inspire us. Use us on your behalf. Amen. In an environment where prayer is either inappropriate or perceived as threatening to some members of the group, a generalized reference to the spirit of goodness within us all, or the love or light within our minds, carries with it the power to bring groups of people into spiritual alignment with each other and a higher power. As an American citizen, you might also wish to participate, by yourself or with others, in a prayer vigil. Beginning on August 11, 1995, people around the world held a 30-day prayer vigil for the people of Bosnia to activate collective spiritual power in response to the suffering brought on by that devastating war. During the 30 days of the vigil, NATO forces acted, causing a profound shift in the course of the Bosnian War. Many thousands of people all around the world had given prayerful support to the effort to stop the violence. If you're interested in saying a prayer vigil for the United States, the following are two prayers which might assist your efforts in holding such a vigil. Dear God, there was born on this land a possibility of freedom more expansive than the world had ever known, and the promise still exists. There is freedom here for some, dear Lord, but clearly not for all, and the promise still exists. Help us, Lord, to free our country from the chains of our hardened hearts. And the promise still exists. Amen. Or this second prayer. Dear God, please bless the people of America and all people throughout the world. Use me, dear God, in whatever way you would have me serve. Show me how to live my life in such a way as to spread the love which feeds and redeems us all. Bless my country. Bless this world. Bless us all. Amen. Putting feet to our prayers. Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The people of every country are the only safe guardians of their own rights and are the only instruments which can be used for their destruction. It is an axiom in my mind that our liberty can never be safe but in the hands of the people themselves." Here are some ways you can both safeguard your rights and exercise them for positive change in the world. Get information on becoming involved. There are many avenues through which you can find out what's happening on a daily, weekly, or monthly basis in our government, both on Capitol Hill and at the White House and at the state and city levels. Cable television seems to launch a new all-news channel as often as they break a story. C-SPAN and C-SPAN 2 show live coverage of Congress when it's in session, important political speeches and panels, as well as programs with viewer call-in segments. One of the easiest ways to become informed is to read the newspaper. It's true that you don't want to overdose on this. In fact, it's a good idea to meditate and pray before you read the paper. But a daily scan of one major paper, particularly the op-ed page, keeps you generally well informed. Most major newspapers are now available on the World Wide Web as well. Most important, don't forget alternative press, such as the Utney Reader. Next, write to your elected officials. It is estimated that fewer than 10% of voters will ever write to elected officials. Yet contacting your elected officials with a letter is an important part of making a difference. They work for you, They theoretically want to hear your views, and they definitely can't afford to ignore them. It's our responsibility to express those views. You may think your elected officials are flooded with letters on issues you care about. The truth is that most members of Congress receive fewer than 100 letters on any one issue. On the state level, elected officials often receive fewer than 10 letters on a particular issue. Your letter can carry a lot of weight. Tips for your letter. Be brief, address only one issue at a time, keep the letter down to 4 or 5 sentences. Say why the issue or legislation matters to you, state your reasons for opposing or supporting a particular bill. If you have particular expertise, then say what it is. Be positive and constructive. Give compliments if they're sincere. Send a copy to your local newspaper to help build support for the issue. Use the appropriate title of the elected official. After you've written once, then keep up the contact and periodically communicate that you're following closely what happens. Thank the official and state that you'll be following up with a phone call in a week to receive a response, and then do so. As effective as one letter is, 25 on the same issue are even better. Getting others who are concerned about the same issue to send letters is not as hard as you might think. Use a citizen salon. Write letters together. Next, write an editorial for your local paper. This is easier than you might think. If you have a strong idea or opinion about a public issue that you'd like to express, write it out. Write it well, communicating your personal experiences. Make your position clear from the beginning. Get right to the subject. Make your sentences relatively short. Be sure all names are correct and all quotations accurate. End your article with a forceful conclusion and write your name, address, and phone numbers on your submission. A good op-ed piece is about 750 words or 3 double-spaced typewritten pages. Write in the active voice, get your facts right, and make sure you're adding some new insight to the argument. Visiting elected officials is another important part of promoting our points of view. A citizen visiting his or her elected officials is visibly identifying himself or herself as a constituent or a voter. Because the official is focusing on you as an individual and as a voter, a visit will have a great impact. Also, investigate online resources. There is a wonderful website that is a kind of all-purpose citizen activism guide. At the Project Vote Smart webpage, www.votesmart.org, entering your zip code will tell you not only who your elected officials are and their addresses, but also everything from their voting records to their biographies to their main funding sources. If you're online, this is a wonderful opportunity to learn how to express yourself and participate powerfully in the process. One more thing, don't forget the companies themselves. When you think a toy is dangerous, or a television show irresponsible, or a corporate position immoral, write the company and let them know. They register complaints more than you might think they do. Look to the audiobook package for ways you can contribute to the waves that create an ocean of power. At my website, www.marianne.com, you can join with others in sharing your thoughts and experiences. How it could work. Liberals are correct that we need to actively help the poor, while conservatives are correct that just giving them handouts only makes things worse. The culture of dependency is not good, but the answer is not to abandon a population in dire crisis. Some of the people we're most fed up with are the way they are because they're in crisis. Our myriad social dysfunctions are not going to go away just because we throw people off welfare and claim that move is some tough love stroke of genius. There are nonprofit models of success all over America, dealing with the deepest layers of the social cancers that plague us. They are usually faith-based operations in which community activism occurs at the most grassroots level. While it is true that such work as theirs is superior to most governmental action, that does not mean that there's no creative role for the government in supporting and complementing their efforts. It's an interesting thing. In business, if someone is a success, his or her work is used as a model throughout the organization. But when it comes to social problems in this country, our government doesn't usually tap into our best resources in the civil sector. Quite the opposite. Someone doing good work with gang members in Philadelphia? Oh, let's have him up for the State of the Union so the president can wave to him from the rostrum. The camera will pick that up. There's a photo op here. I can feel it, absolutely. That's far from inviting a person to sit at a table of power. Civil sector efforts should not be patronized by an arrogant governmental system. We need to declare national recovery, not just as a tired campaign slogan, but as seriously and powerfully as we at other times have declared war. It's going to take a lot more than a pep rally to get people involved in a massive effort to heal America. It will take a seriously coordinated effort, yes, involving money, but also involving the most sophisticated organizational and motivational wisdom. Mentoring, for instance, is the only known antidote to juvenile delinquency. 1 hour spent with a responsible adult each week can turn a young person's life completely around, even if that adult is not a family member, and even if the young person is already in his or her late teens. Millions of Americans would respond to an intelligent call to join a citizen crusade to mentor our young and otherwise repair the broken places in American society. They would do it if they actually knew where to go, who to call, and how their work might make a difference. We should be able to call a 1-800 number, which plugs us into the best use of our efforts to serve the larger community. They're not fun anymore. Should we still call them parties? The failure of American politics to engage us fully is not an inherent weakness in the American system of government, but only in the entrenched political establishment that would have us believe we have no alternative to them. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says you will be divided into two main political parties, Democrats and Republicans, and together they will determine the direction of the country, even if that direction is into the ground. Their shared dominance of our political system is merely a product of our own malaise. They're so big for no other reason than that we've all played so small. If democracy is a river that would provide the water to help us spring back to life, current politics is a dam that holds the water back. It is a conversation stuck at the level of a shouting match, an adversarial us-versus-them debate of total polarization and very little synergy. If we were serious about democracy, voting registration would occur automatically on an American citizen's 18th birthday. Voting would be held on Saturday or Sunday, and possibly, as in other countries, for more than one day. And the polls would be open 24 hours. It cannot be said that the current system encourages voter participation. If we were serious about democracy, we would mandate free TV time for all candidates, where they are free to speak for themselves, but their Madison Avenue handlers have to keep their paws off our brains. Our political candidates should not be sold like soda pop. If we were serious about democracy, our legislators would not feel free to continuously avoid grappling with the challenge of limiting the influence of money on the electoral system. Americans have turned off to politics now because they know it's all just become a game. What we need to remember, however, is that while current politics is just a game, democracy is not. It's as though we own a house and we do not like the current tenants. You don't avoid the house or burn down the house. You remove the tenants. Nespa? What should I do? Sitting around waiting for someone to tell us what to do is not in keeping with the gift of democracy. The zeitgeist now is to do the one thing that each of us knows is the pure thing that stands before us on the road of life. The undone task of personal growth or community involvement that paves the way to our higher becoming. That is the critical issue in democracy today. That each of us rises to the nobler places within us, to the stuff of integrity, excellence, and love. No one can lift the fog in your mind except you yourself. Some of us need to read more. Some of us need to pray more. Some of us need to go to therapy. Some of us need to get sober. Some of us need to get a job. Some of us need to be more generous. Some of us need to participate more fully in our family or our community. Some of us need to forgive someone. Some of us need to ask forgiveness. Almost all of us need to become more politically involved. All of us need to do something that we know is the next step in the journey of our soul's unfoldment, and most of us know deep in our hearts what that is. Leadership itself is changing from a top-down, old-fashioned Newtonian model of someone acting on a system from the outside to try to change it, to a new paradigm image of change from within. The primary responsibility of leadership in the era now upon us is to hold a space for the genius of others. In the presence of someone who believes in us, we move more quickly into who we might become. But the major work to be done is still up to each of us. In the words of Francis Bacon, knowledge is power. There are universal laws of consciousness that apply to social change. I think of them as the rules of Renaissance. Number one, It is always our prerogative as individuals and as nations to choose again, to say no to a direction we've been moving in and yes to a new one. Our greatest power is our capacity to change our minds. Number two, alignment with higher principle is always supported by invisible forces. In the words of Dr. King, even though the arc of the moral universe is long, it bends toward justice. Number three, if an energy is not in alignment with divine truth, it is ultimately temporary and more vulnerable than it appears. Number four, the universe is impersonally invested in evolving toward goodness and uses any available conduit for the purposes of doing so. Willingness to be so used activates the conduit. You're as good for the job as anyone else, and your past is totally irrelevant. Number five, don't expect the old order to like you. Number six, a life of love and effort on behalf of the collective good promises the satisfaction of knowing that you're doing what you were born to do. You are not, however, promised specific results as you might define them. Number seven, your happiness regarding the reality that's coming is a more potent method of social conversion than is your anger regarding the reality now. As my father used to say, you know, now do. Home of the Brave. I heard United States Congressman Walter Capps tell the following story. It is a traditional rabbinical tale. A rabbi was giving instruction to some children when he posed this question, how do you know the night is over and the day has come? Puzzled, the children took some time to answer. Then one of them ventured, you know the night is over and the day has come when at dawn you look out at a tree and you can tell whether it's an apple or a pear tree. The rabbi acknowledged this response but repeated the question. A second student offered, you know the night is over and the day has come when you see an animal in the distance and you can tell whether it's a donkey or a horse. The rabbi acknowledged this response too, then repeated the question. At this, the students, too puzzled to know how to answer, asked the rabbi to solve the dilemma he had posed. The rabbi said, you know the night is over and the day has come. When you look into the eyes of any human being and you see there your brother or your sister, for if you do not see your brother or your sister, it is still night. The day has not come. Dr. King said this in the 1960s. Through our scientific genius, we have made of the world a neighborhood. Now, through our moral and spiritual genius, we must make of it a brotherhood. We have before us the glorious opportunity to inject a new dimension of love into the veins of our civilization. The whole world is in His hands. If we could at this time shrink the Earth's population to a village of precisely 100 people, with all existing human ratios remaining the same, it would look like this. There would be 57 Asians, 21 Europeans, 14 from the Western Hemisphere, both North and South, and 8 Africans. 70 would be non-white, 30 white. 70 would be non-Christian, 30 Christian. 50% of the entire world wealth would be in the hands of only 6 people. All 6 would be citizens of the United States. 70 would be unable to read. 50 would suffer from malnutrition. 80 would live in substandard housing. Only 1 would have a college education. America needs a truer sense of our relationship to a world much larger than we. We are neither alone nor better than anyone else. Americans are so propagandized to think that certain things are the better way simply because they are our way. We are a 200-year-old society in the habit of giving lectures about high civilization to people who have been around for hundreds, even thousands of years. Our own homelessness, poverty, violence, and crisis in healthcare make living in certain other nations look like a day at the beach compared to America. Yet we hold forth on how the citizens of those nations could have what we have if only they would do what we do. The average American is less well-read and informed about world events and situations than are our European counterparts. Our children are less well-educated, and we are the only Western industrialized nation that does not have universal health care. We lecture others about human rights, sometimes legitimately, while other nations regard health care as a human right. We go about singing the praises of democracy, but we don't ask ourselves why, if we love it so much, we don't make it easier for people to vote. We talk endlessly about family values in this country while taking less good care of our children than any other nation with similar resources to do so. President Kennedy said, "I am certain that after the dust of centuries has passed from our cities, we too will be remembered not for victories or defeats in battle and politics, but for our contribution to the human spirit." Soldiers of Peace. The guardians of the status quo intimidate us with their analytical left brain power. It is not there, but in our hearts and our imaginations, that we will find a way to renew the world. When King Saul offered young David his armor to wear in doing battle with the giant, David put it on, but then removed it. He wasn't comfortable with the old way of battle. He had to trust his own heart and do things another way. Soldiers of Peace will create a new world. I saw a photograph on the front page of a newspaper in the fall of 1996 showing an American soldier in Bosnia physically keeping apart two women who were having a violent argument. One woman was a Muslim seeking to return to her home, and the other was a Serb trying to keep her away. The soldier, one of America's peacekeepers in the region, was a valiant referee. And yet, I thought, as I looked down at that picture, wouldn't it be wonderful if the soldier himself had the tools to actually help these women heal their relationship? The armies and police of our future will include conflict resolution as part of their training. In some places, they already do. The fact that the term peacekeeper was invented means our society has evolved to the point where we are ready to embrace its potential meaning. Conflict resolution is to peace what guns are to war. The full actualization of its potential, however, remains on the horizon. Imagine a world in which war no longer exists. That world is not just around the corner, obviously, but we begin a journey of 1,000 miles by taking one step. "More than an end to war, we want an end to the beginning of all wars," wrote President Franklin Roosevelt, who died before delivering his speech for a Jefferson Day broadcast in 1945. Only thoughts of peace can eradicate the beginnings of war. Only a new political sensibility arising throughout the world can counter the war machine always lurking in the background of international affairs. We must be bold enough to state what kind of world we want, instead of always trying to accomplish small games within a system we know is ultimately destructive. Traveling in India with a group of fellow Americans, I had a meeting with His Holiness the Dalai Lama. His Holiness told me that a German physicist had said to him that we should remove the concept of foreign policy from our minds and think of all nations as our domestic partners. According to the esoteric wisdom of the ages, every nation carries with it a facet of divine light as it streams from the mind of God to earth. The soulful function associated with the United States is to light the way. We must find again our own light. We're no longer known around the world as the great champion of democracy. We're known as the great underminer of communism, to be sure, but that is far from synonymous with being a champion of democracy. We have sabotaged democratic governments as well as communist governments when they did not move in the direction we wanted them to move, and even today we sell out oppressed democratic forces for a greater market share in their country's economies. The Dalai Lama told me, "The people of the world no longer look at America as a champion of democracy. Too many times we have seen you take the side of the undemocratic forces." When we were in India meditating at the Taj Mahal, the Mufti, Egypt's highest Muslim cleric, happened to pass our group as he walked through the area with his entourage. Seeing a group of Westerners meditating at the Taj Mahal made him curious, and he asked who we were. Upon being told we were a group of Christians and Jews from the United States, many of us clergy, he asked if he could meet with a small group of us later at his hotel. The meeting was very formal, and the Mufti spoke through an interpreter. His basic message to us was this. "I am aware," he said, "that for most Americans, when you hear the word Islamic, you usually hear the word terrorist in the same sentence. I wanted to speak with you to make sure you understand that Islam is a religion of peace." Every people, he said, has a dark element, a group which does not represent the larger group well. Obviously, we have ours. But please do not think that Islamic terrorists represent true Islam, any more than Christians who commit violence in the name of God represent true Christianity, or Jews who commit violence in the name of God represent true Judaism. After our meeting with the Mufti, as I made my way through the lobby of the hotel, one of the Egyptians who was attending His Eminence tapped me on the shoulder and asked if we could speak. During that very week, a group of Indian women threatened to burn themselves alive in protest of the Miss Universe pageant being held in New Delhi. What they were protesting was the imposition of Western standards of beauty on Indian women, expressing the resentment that many people throughout the Third World feel toward America. The Egyptian diplomat said to me, "I do not mean this as a criticism of the United States. I know the Americans are good men and women, but please try to make them understand. Many people in my part of the world feel that they have been forced to try to keep up with you in a race that we do not really care to run. Your technology," he said, "is amazing, but America seems spiritually polluted to many of us. Your ways are not our ways, and while we were tempted for a while to think that your ways should be our ways, we do not think that anymore." "This is the problem, Miss Williamson," he said to me, "and there will be terrible consequences in the world if Americans do not come to understand this. Islamic terrorists have had success, if you would call their campaigns a success, because they have been able to persuade millions of peasants that America is bad. It was not too difficult to do, Miss Williamson. All they had to do is describe the television programs America exports to this part of the world, and millions of our people were very horrified. Your government does not understand. They do not see how the people feel. We need the American people to understand. Perhaps you will bring more Americans to our part of the world. If they come to understand us, then they will respect us. We would feel that respect, and then I don't think that the terrorists would have such success. This is not a job the CIA can do. It is only a job which people can do." I thanked him for telling me those things, and I promised him I would pass the information on. America is not now the home of the brave, but I think we are the home of those who wish to be brave. Coming to JFK Airport from Cairo at the beginning of 1997, I handed my landing card to the agent at the customs counter. He read what I had written. "What do you do?" he asked me. "I'm a writer," I replied. "What do you write?" "I'm writing a book called The Healing of America." He looked at me. "Well, America is shot," he said. I didn't say anything. "You ought to come here for a day," he said, "to do research for your book. Come see what I see. These people are terrible." I was rather shocked. "Do you mean immigrants?" "Well," he hesitated, "Americans are the worst, but they're all bad. I came here wanting to like everybody, you know, thinking everybody's fairly decent. But immigrants now aren't like the immigrants 50 years ago. They might be good when they first come here, but after being around Americans for a couple of months, they're just as bad as we are." I thought for a few moments, and then I ventured a comment. "Well, I have an idea that might help." "Really?" he asked. "When people come up to you here, look them in the eye and silently say, 'The goodness in me salutes the goodness in you.'" He thought for a moment. "Would that maybe really work, you think?" "Oh, yes," I said, "really." He smiled and stamped my card, showing me which way to exit. As I reached the door leading out, I looked back at the agent. He was looking at me. We both stood still for several moments, and both of us were silent. The ancient Egyptians believed the stars in our eyes are reflections of the stars in the sky, and that the stars in the sky are our home. I had heard that in Egypt, but I learned it's true in America. I saw the stars in my brother's eyes, and I knew that I was home.
The Healing of America was written and read by Marianne Williamson. It was abridged for audio by Treby Johnson with Jan Werner. The recording engineer was Jamie Cerniglia, with editing by Rob Weisberg. The mix engineer was Rick Bradley. The associate producer was Florence Barreau Adams. The Healing of America was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Healing of America is also available in hardcover from Simon & Schuster.